You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob. So I keep getting these one after another, these incomprehensible instructions for how to vote. This one says options for returning your vote by mail. It has three options, but it's completely unclear whether I have to vote by mail or not. Is there a regular election coming or not? There's a little thing about safe and accessible in-person voting options in the left on the right-hand side, but they clearly don't really emphasize it. Then I got another one saying, all registered voters have been mailed a vote by mail ballot. Vote safely at home, make your voice heard. Has no mention of in-person voting at all. And they're all sort of done in this sort of Gen Z sort of new format where things are sort of floating on white space and it's not clear where you should go. And then I get something that says, wait, there's more. All at the in-person vote center, press the button to review all choices. So it turns out there is an in-person vote center. Who knew? And anyway, go ahead.
You know what the people who designed that lack? It's two words, one of my favorite terms.
Cognitive empathy?
You got it. They failed to put themselves in the shoes of the average person who would open that envelope and try to make sense
absolutely
of the literature.
And also the average aging boomer. There are two lessons to be learned from this. I think one is the lesson of bandwidth, the key boomer concept, which is shortage of bandwidth, which is it's not enough to have everything explained to you over pamphlet after pamphlet. You don't have the mental space to find the right answer, and you don't want to deal with the right answer, deal with having to find the right answer, even if it's readily available. That was the beauty of Election Day. All you knew is you had to go to the polls and vote, and it was done.
Yeah.
And that was simple, as opposed to this chazarai.
Our age can't handle that kind of shit. In fact, what kind of shit? I've forgotten what we're talking about. See, this is what I mean. What are we talking about?
And the second thing is, because turnout doesn't necessarily go down with all this junk, but it does force people to turn to third parties for help, just the way complicated tax forms force
and
you to turn to H&R
Block. And
might
some of those people
Block.
Commit fraud, Mickey? Might some of those third parties commit fraud?
They might be canvassers. I'm desperate. I will happily welcome my friendly canvasser who understands all these rules and will explain them all to me and handle my ballot for me.
And might commit fraud.
Is
that where we're heading? No.
They might lose my ballot when they realize that
I'm
not voting the straight line Democratic ticket. Yeah.
Not to be confused with fraud. They would just lose something. We all lose things.
It's just an accident, like something falling off a truck in New Jersey. Anyway, that's my opening spiel. It's very annoying.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that around, a lot of bad design around. You know, in fact, that's why we had to endure two terms of George W. Bush. Remember the Florida ballot design in that one place where clearly
that
would have made
design.
The difference if it hadn't been completely baffling. There were clearly a lot of people, and that would have swung the state if the people who meant to vote for Gore had their votes.
But it was also obviously. Something that could not be overturned by a court. You couldn't say, oh, these are Jews. They would never vote for Buchanan. They must have meant to vote for Gore. No court, no judge was going to decide
that.
Definitely
can't say that. Can't even say, obviously, some significant percentage with this ballot design meant to vote for Gore and not Bush.
And you know who the person was who wanted to double down on this completely doomed theory as the Gore spaceship was heading augury into the ground.
Which theory?
Wanted to emphasize the butterfly ballot theory, which was a loser, even though it was completely as an equitable matter, it was correct.
But
it was not going to win in court, as opposed to checking the overvotes, which they neglected to do, which would have won Gore the election.
Let me guess. I don't know. Joe Lieberman?
No, he that Dang. Person was Ron Klain, Bob. and Biden's chief of staff, who was in the process of not doing anything differently as the Biden spaceship augurs her to the ground.
So yet another person who helped get us into the Iraq war is promoted instead of demoted.
Was he? Did he help us get it?
Bush elected, apparently, according to you.
But he was working for Gore.
I know, but he helped get Bush elected, and Bush invaded Iraq. It's a really subtle and complicated joke. I should target a younger demographic.
He may well have wanted us to get involved in Iraq. I don't know. It's inexplicable why he's still there.
I didn't mean he wanted it. It was a joke.
But here's the question: do you think Gore would have gotten involved in Iraq?
Well, it's commonly assumed he wouldn't. I'm not sure at all. I mean, after all, Joe Lieberman was his running mate. And who was his? Was it this Firth guy? Was his national security guy? He was his administration. And I mean, after all, who was one of his biggest boosters? Our friend Marty Peretz.
I agree with all that. And I still don't think he could have pulled the trigger.
It's hard to say. I'll tell you, it was crazy times. I mean, look, all the people who would have restrained him. All of the so-called progressives and liberals supported the war. Who would have stopped him? What?
I mean, people like Josh Marshall, who supported the war, had bailed by the time the war was actually a
prospect. Yeah, but Slate, the New Yorker. I mean, come on, these bastions of at that point, these mainstays of liberal, supposedly democratic thought.
Mike Kinsey would have stopped it.
I think Gore might spend more time talking to Marty than to Mike. I'm not sure, but
maybe Mike would have gotten to Marty.
I don't think Mike was all that passionately against the war.
I don't think Marty had that much influence on Gore. Didn't he eventually turn on him a bit?
I think he once said
Gore
that
didn't
take
his advice.
At one point, I think he said that they spoke by phone almost every day. I think he said that.
But what did they speak about? Maybe they were talking about great songs from the 60s or something.
Could have been. So,
I don't know.
Maybe we're spending so much time on this because once again, the main story of the week is depressing. This is the second week in a row where a mass shooting is kind of the biggest story.
Yes.
That's horrible.
And it looks like there is... You know, I was always despairing of gun control, even though I'm sort of weak on the subject. I'm not in step with my conservative friends because anything that could get through Congress, anything that was tolerable was ineffective. But it looks like they are going to do, they are working on some combination of a mildly expanded background checks and red flag laws. It wouldn't be a federal red flag requirement. It would be, you know, grants encouraging states to adopt red flag laws.
And what's an example of a red flag law?
Oh, I don't know. I guess if you torture a small animal outside the school, or you visit the school psychiatrist and say, and exhibit symptoms that are required to be reported, or you beat up your wife. I guess that it's like a FICO score. And I'm waiting for the Silicon Valley genius to propose a FICO score like thing for your propensity to commit mass murder. So that, you know, that in Davos this week, there was a guy got a lot of grief for proposing tracking every person's carbon usage by computer. In other words, you have it's not like a Chinese social credit score. It's like a Chinese social credit score, but only focused on your carbon usage. Mm-hmm. And somebody's going to take that crazy idea, which I find horrible, and say, let's do it for people who have a propensity to be like this shooter. And it's a little less crazy there, or it's still pretty crazy. But I mean, it seems inevitable that somebody's going to.
Yeah, I mean, there. I'm sure there's data that would be statistically predictive. I mean, I don't know what the literature is, for example, on video games, but this guy apparently from a young age played a lot of first person shooter games. Wouldn't shock me if mass shooters are disproportionately likely to have done that.
If you got a whole bunch of data that, you know, the government doesn't have, like, do you have a girlfriend? Do you have good relations with your parents? Do you have male friends? Are you on a sports team? All sports team would be a positive. You could
depends on the sport, but
you could be much more. Really, what sport would be a negative?
No, I'm kind of joking. I'm guessing. It's a good question. But no, you're right. Kind of mainstream social involvement is probably a negative indicator of likelihood to do this.
Anyway, you could probably come up with a score that was much more accurate than just the absence of red flags.
I'm sure you could. Certainly, if you monitored, social media behavior and stuff, I'm sure they could come up with an AI thing that, would do a better than, just chance job. I don't know, how effective. If this accelerates, you'll start probably hearing calls for that. I'm still surprised by how many less ominous things in that there are that are considered too radical to pass in Congress. One example would be just saying that you can't buy a gun until you're 21 instead of 18. I mean, look, this guy, the Buffalo shooter, the Parkland shooter, I think the Sandy Hook shooter, Columbine shooter, I think they were all under 21, right? And look, this wouldn't be foolproof. Some of them would manage to get guns anyway. And for that matter, you probably wouldn't be making possession illegal. So if their parents wanted to buy one, but a couple of these people were people who probably would have had trouble finding somebody to help them buy an assault rifle, They didn't have any friends, obviously, as crazy as them. Their parents weren't going to do it, So you do the little things you can, and yet, apparently, even this could not get 10 Republican votes in the Senate. You can't drink until you're 21. I mean, is this so crazy? Pretty much. I mean, I think that's still technically state by state, but I think the federal government created some major incentive. I forget what it is. For states to raise the drinking level. I mean, when I went to high school in Texas, drinking age was 18. Now it's 21.
It is plausible that these shooters, by the time they're 21, they will either have flipped out completely in some other way, or they will have managed to get their lives together.
Just an increment of greater, self-control or they'll have finally met a woman or something. All kinds of things can happen that, these guys are often right on the edge. It may happen. It may not happen. Anything you can do to decrease the chances. My other hobby horse, which has even less chance of ever happening, is banning high capacity magazines. I think this guy had a 30 bullet magazine. In this case, it didn't matter. But in the Buffalo case, I think that guy killed everyone he killed without reloading. And you never know what if he had to stop and reload. First of all, bad things can happen. He can get flustered. It certainly gives people more of a chance to rush him. You just never know. I mean, I think you do the things you can do around the edges to slightly decrease the chances without egregiously infringing on civil liberties. Why not do all those things? I assure you the founders were not thinking, man, what one thing that would clearly violate the Second Amendment is if you could only shoot, 8 shots in a row without reloading, right? I mean, you could only shoot one shot without reloading in those days.
I must admit it. When I think of my marksmanship, I think I would need more than 8 shots. But the founders clearly wanted you to be able to protect yourself. They wanted you to be able to rebel against authority if there was a time when the authorities got oppressive and you wouldn't want to be stripped of your guns. Does that require more than 8 bullets? I don't know.
Self-defense does not. I mean, can I just say something about people who buy guns for self-defense? If when they are used violently, it is almost always either to commit suicide or to murder someone. Okay, that's what actually happens with guns that are bought for self-defense. But in terms of actually defending your home, I would guess, I have no date on this, but I would guess that 99% of the times they are successful in defense. What happens is intruder breaks in, either sees the gun or you fire two shots and he runs away. That's what happens. There aren't many cases where someone comes to your house and their plan is to murder you with an assault rifle, right? It just, you know, I mean, again, you can, it's kind of like torture in the ticking bomb scenario. You can come up with these scenarios that won't actually happen more than one times in a million, but they don't happen more than one times in a million.
What if you're a woman living at the end of a dirt road in the Western United States where there's nobody else around and you don't know who's going to come down that dirt road and you want to be able to protect yourself if they do? I don't know that 8 bullets is enough, but what if there are 2 people coming down the dirt road?
By 2 pistols, again, if eight shots doesn't stop them, you're probably in serious trouble, you know, in any event. In other words, another 8 probably isn't going to help. But it's just like, yeah, it's like, Mickey, we used to have these arguments when I was against torture being legal. As I recall, you were for it. And you would come up with these crazy scenarios that have literally never, ever happened and have almost no chance of ever happening. Okay. You can always do that. You know, try to imagine a woman living alone who won't manage to discourage an intruder by firing 8 bullets at his face. Okay. That will not lead him to flinch. Okay. I suppose there's a movie in which that happens, but it's just not, you know.
Well, the one thing I don't, the one argument that's often made that I don't buy is the argument on the right that says, look at Chicago and New York. They have strict gun control laws and they have out of control murders way, way more than other areas. But just as we argue that Chicago and New York have weird, sick cultures in some way, that it might mean that gun control laws, yes, they won't work there, but they will work in a lot of rural areas where you don't have gangs and a huge, I guess you can't call it an underclass anymore, a lot of high crime areas, you have a shot at actually having an incremental, a positive effect, because most people, will obey the law and find it hard to get a gun if guns are illegal.
Well, also, if you can cross state lines, if the law is not uniform across the country, I think the high capacity magazines are illegal in New York. I believe he crossed state lines to get his 30 bullet magazine. And that's why some of these things you pretty much have to address at a federal level.
The state line argument, though, has always seemed to be a cop out for excusing a culture where you're just going to be able to get it. You can get heroin. Heroin is one of the most illegal things around. Okay, you can get heroin. You're going to be able to get a magazine.
You can get that. As for magazines, I would say 2 things. If you were serious about it, again, I realize this is politically impossible. I mean, this is America. You can't get anything serious done legislatively. But the way I would do it is I would first of all have a very generous buyback program. So everybody who has a magazine that's too big, you buy it back. And then after that, you make possession itself illegal. Doesn't mean you're going into people's houses looking for them. But if you stop a guy and he's driving drunk, so you search his car and you find a high capacity magazine, that he does jail time for that. I mean, that's the way if you're going to do it, but none of this is going to happen.
Buying back guns seems fruitless because the arsenal, as they call it,
I'm talking about magazines,
as existing guns is so big, you could never make a dent in it, but maybe with magazines, the arsenal is less.
Look, you could get 5 billionaires to contribute enough money to pay for that. Cause that's the kind of cause that they would support.
I think the billionaires are going to go for this FICO score for shooters. Myself,
it's an interesting question. They'll probably go for both. There are actually a lot of libertarians in Silicon Valley, so it's an interesting question. On the other hand,
but then why is Silicon Valley creating an Orwellian nightmare state of
one of the
social
ironies.
Surveillance?
We can refer to this as the Peter Thiel irony, perhaps, given I think what some of his software does.
Actually, that's a good point. Peter Thiel probably already could do this.
Do what? You mean
track potential shooters.
He may be
Palantir software.
Yeah. It's doable. And this is, you know, I just want to, a thing I said in the distant past, I think I said it in my book, Non-Zero even, is like, you know, people think of a two-dimensional trade-off between like liberty and security. I mean, a one-dimensional, a spectrum of two ends, but there is another dimension, which is just how many people are hateful and want to do horrible things to other people. You know, the less hatred there is, the more you can have security without sacrificing liberty. And that's why, look, the one true thing that opponents of gun control say is like, look, this is largely about problems in our culture. It is largely about problems in our culture, but I still think you do what you can around the edges. The problems in our culture are hard to legislate away. I think we should think about those too, but they're hard to ban.
For some reason, I'm never very sympathetic to the lower the temperature arguments you make.
But you want to raise the temperature?
No, I just figure if people are going to go kill people, they're going to go kill people.
Well, no, but if they're not crazy and filled with rage, Mickey, all of these guys are crazy and filled with rage. If they weren't that, they wouldn't do this. I'm not saying I know how to end it, but I am saying, you know, this is a problem to an extent that it didn't used to be a problem. And I don't think it's just because there are so many guns floating around.
Yeah. Well, it looks like, you know, they are talking, the Democrats have gotten smart. They realized they took the lesson of the Sandy Hill shooting. Is that the name of
Sandy Hook
shooting. I hope Sandy Hill doesn't hear this. She's a friend of mine. Sandy Hook.
The system is scanning her history, even as we speak, Mickey. The AI picked up on that.
Sandy Hook shooting happened just as Obama's agenda was headed for the final crunch. And you knew, at least I knew, and I think other people knew, that if he took the bait and spent a month on a fruitless gun control effort, it was going to make him run out of time on the rest of his agenda. And he did it in part with encouragement from Biden, I believe, and he ran out of time on the rest of his agenda. So it was a disaster. Schumer is very smart. He doesn't want to waste a month on this. If he can get something in a short period of time, he's going to do it, but he has other fish to fry. They all seem to involve Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin has said he's ready to negotiate on guns. There's a group that's a gang of senators, that's a bipartisan group that's negotiating guns. The Democrats are not going for a big legislative win like raising the age to 21. They're going for these small incremental wins like red flag laws and grants for red flag laws and a little more background checks. And so there's room for negotiation. It's still very difficult, but that's happening. And Manchin has also indicated that he's willing to go along with the big thing that Schumer really wants to get passed, which is some form of Build Back Better, some vestigial form that basically raises taxes, lowers the deficit, and has some energy grants. If it doesn't have the things that there are a lot of good things it could also have in it, including subsidies for Obamacare to cure the original flaws of Obamacare. But I don't think it's going to have those. Mm-hmm. As long as it doesn't have the refundable child tax credit, I have no particular axe to grind against it. It would boost Biden's chances a bit.
I'm always in favor of raising taxes on rich people. And contrary to what Jeff Bezos suggested a couple of weeks ago when he suddenly got edgy and spunky with Biden, that does tend to be anti-inflationary, I think. Deficit spending is inflationary and the opposite is anti-inflationary.
Iglesias pointed that out and nobody else picked up on it. Everybody gave Bezos shit for saying that. But in fact, Who did they give shit? No, I'm giving shit to Bezos. They didn't give Bezos shit, right? They didn't give Bezos enough.
He got some shit from you know, liberal economists. I don't know, but it was such a weird case. I think he's getting Elon Musk envy. It's like Musk is, you know,
totally,
and so he's got to, like, you know, I mean, well, but choose your spots more carefully is what I recommend.
The inflation figure that just came out was lower than expected.
Oh, I didn't know that. Was that like today?
4.9% today. I'm waiting for Jason Furman to weigh in. So you think there might be a base effect because it was higher last year? I don't know.
I have no idea.
It's been interpreted as signs that inflation may be slowing down. I'd wait for Jason Furman to weigh in. I checked his Twitter feed before we taped. He didn't have a reaction. He was in Davos saying that now that inflation has taken hold of the world economy, don't kid yourself. The central banks are going to have to do much more than they're letting on they're going to have to do to bring inflation under control. So, don't abandon the idea that every time the stock market goes down, the Fed is going to do something to boost it back up. It might keep going down. So you don't want to buy on the dips, mm-hmm. as I just did.
Or did you?
That's a mistake.
Well,
I have only $1,000 and I blew it all on investing in an index fund that I've made now $30.
Just tracks the S&P or something.
This was a high tech index fund, but I figured that's more volatile.
Well,
but
if you're diving back in, I mean, once this gets out, now that it's public, I mean, I'll tell you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to buy in between now and when we post this, because when we post this, all your followers.
Isn't that illegal insider trading? Isn't that like Bill? Well, this weird story came out on Breitbart. It wasn't completely nailed down, but it was very interesting, if true, that Bill Gates is funding a lot of organizations that trash Elon Musk. So it's not just that he's shorted Musk's stock, it is he's spending his millions and billions to drive the stock down. Now, is that illegal? Probably not.
Probably not.
It's not insider trading. But it's a secret dark fund. He's not being transparent about it. And second, why would Bill Gates do this? He has plenty of money. Well, he doesn't need to make profits.
I mean, you saw
he doesn't need to make profits on Musk's stock.
Did you see Musk's tweet about Bill Gates? This is probably retaliation for that.
He said he was pregnant. I think he's been doing it for a while. No, I think Musk was onto
it. No, he showed him a picture of him looking overweight and said something that your average 13-year-old would say when tweeting a picture of somebody he didn't like who looked overweight. Yeah, that's what Elon Musk does.
What did he say?
I forget the joke, but the whole idea.
It was a pregnant man emoji. It was a pregnant man emoji. It was not, he was just overweight.
Okay, but he's making fun of him for being overweight. How old are most of us when we stop doing that? Donald Trump excluded. How old are most of us when we stop doing
that? Well, it's like one of those things where, you know, if you're a normal person, you stop it when you're 18. But if you're in the elite, you probably keep doing it for your entire life.
I don't think it works that way. Quite the contrary. Traditionally, the people who have risen to high levels in the establishment, the elite, are people who stopped doing it earlier than you and I did. That's why
and they go to clubs, and at the clubs they say, you know, Bill Gates is disgustingly fat. Yeah. You know, I mean, tell it to Joe Rogan.
Still, the idea that, you know, a guy with Elon Musk's record on Twitter, just looking at his record of juvenile tweets, could well wind up running Twitter is an appropriate comment on the general direction of reality lately, I guess. So it's just sit back and enjoy it, I guess.
I mean, you know, another guy who made juvenile sex jokes was Stephen Hawking. I mean, you know, what can you say?
Stephen Hawking?
He was filthy. Well,
yeah,
there were all sorts of like weird quantum dirty jokes.
I think you got to give him credit between his genius and his physical malady.
I give him credit. I'm just saying that it doesn't bother me that much that he had a juvenile sense of humor when it came to sex.
You know, he did manage apparently to have an affair with his nurse, which is hard enough.
More than I've done.
Me, right. So my hat's off to him.
Anyway, I just think Gates is cruising for a bruising there.
Well, he's getting it. So there's so many conspiracy theories directed at him, you know?
Well, it started with Epstein. I mean, that's the...
Epstein, you know...
He's like Denspec. He's distracting from the Epstein scandal by opening up a whole new scandal. So everybody forgets that he was pals with Epstein.
That could be it. He is a smart guy. But, you know, the Bill Gates microchip in the vaccine, you realize you've got how many of those floating around? Three by now. You got three Bill Gates microchips in you.
There was this, I missed that. What did you say? I was thinking.
You know, the theory that the vaccine is used to get Bill Gates microchips into your body, which a number of people actually believe. I mean, an alarming number of people.
Well, I'm waiting for the next Severance show where they, in order to stop high school shootings, they insert a chip into every young male that goes off every time they...
We can arrange that. Have you watched more of Severance since we spoke last week?
Yeah, I've watched, on like episode 3.
Okay, so we can talk about that in the pair.
Anyway,
but we digress.
Anyway, I forget. Oh, there was this hilarious thing in Business Insider where Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn...
It was
a scandal because he had planned and he had invited Musk to a dinner with Jeff Bezos, Jeffrey Epstein, Joichi Ito, the guy from MIT, and him, and Peter Thiel, and it sounds like a dinner you could have a one act play entirely based on this dinner, and it would be an interesting thing. But of course, there's no evidence this dinner ever happened. I mean, he invited him. I mean, Bob, I invite you to a dinner with Jeff
all the
Bezos
time.
And Elon Musk, and we're going to get Zelensky in, you know, from and Prince Bandar and all, you know.
I've been to dinners you organized where the advertised guest did not show up, Mickey.
In real life. Have you organized those dinners?
No, you organized them. There was all this glittery bait. Bob, want to come to dinner? All these people will be there. You know,
That happens all the time.
That's my point. It happens. That's your point.
But that happened. That was an accident. There are people who do it intentionally.
Anyway, it happens.
But you had me, Bob. I know that's enough.
Yeah.
So on Ukraine.
Yeah.
The big news was Henry Kissinger, I think.
Not the only news.
Okay, go ahead.
It was also the news that, first of all, I should say I've been doing an experiment this week. I have stayed almost entirely off of Twitter and entirely off my Twitter Ukraine list. And as a result, all I know is what the mainstream media is reporting. And as I've argued before, the mainstream media is usually... If there's bad news for Ukraine, they're usually several days behind it on it. In fact, I would like to play you a clip from the BBC today where they're saying basically what I told you a week ago, as if it was news. Can I do that?
Yes.
So as you may recall, I was saying, like, if you follow the kind of pro-Russia Twitter, you get a sense for things well before sometimes they are actually reported. In this case, I said, I think it was the second week in a row, I mentioned this town, Popasna. I said they had been saying for a long time, it's important. Finally, the Russians took it weeks ago. And then last week, I said, I'm not sure this is real yet, but it looks like there's been a breakout. I mean, the Russians took Popasna, but now it looks like there's been a breakout and they're heading from it west and north and south and everything. No signs in the mainstream media. Today was the first time in mainstream media I saw a reference to Popasna or heard. It was in the BBC. I'm going to play it. The other thing I had said was one implication of this is that for this, among other reasons, this town of Severodonetsk, a big, big, important city, will now be imperiled and either the Ukrainians will withdraw or there will be a big battle or something. So anyway, I finally heard a reference a week later to Papasna. This guy pronounces it Papasna, but you'll get the idea.
And towards Lysychansk. So the only way they're going to be able to properly encircle it is by cutting off a whole pocket of territory coming round the back. And that's what they're trying to do at the moment. They've come through this town called Popasna, which is on the old line of control. That was one of the front lines was near there. They've broken through there and they're trying to come round the back, going kind of through a town called Bakhmut. And that would
encircle. I mean, I'm serious. Yeah. I really said this. I mean, there's a little. There's been a little more, but and this is a fuller report and everything. But there is this lag in reporting bad news for Ukraine that I've kind of figured out the dynamics of it. Maybe I'll go into it in the paragraph.
I think that's kind of changing because I was reading Anne Applebaum's latest piece about how why we must pursue Putin's ultimate defeat and humiliation mm-hmm. as our war goal, as opposed to taking the Henry Kissinger approach, which is giving him an off-ramp where he actually gets some territory. And that's the dividing line now. And she has shifted. The old line was Putin is insane and he's losing, so we must stop him now. And now while we have the advantage, now her line is shifted and it's now Putin is rational and he's winning, so we must stop him now.
Right.
Either way, the result is always the same, but the anti-Putin people have completely incorporated the idea that he's doing okay. And
but you know, that's a swing over the last two or three days, so far as I can tell. I mean, whereas there was evidence of it many days earlier.
Yeah. But I guess the argument that he's not about to take this off-ramp. He thinks he's doing fine. There's, you know, no point in offering him an off-ramp, blah, 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 blah. And he's rational. So, of course, he won't launch nuclear weapons when we say our goal is to depose him and destroy his government and his way of life. I mean, that, that as Roth Douth had pointed out, that is the weakness of Applebaum's piece. If the more she ups the war aims to destroy Putin, the more likely it is nuclear weapons will seem like his only option.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that's why I can't believe how much grief Kissinger took, because I think he was basically saying, look, the most you can hope for is to get back to the status quo ante, which would be, first of all, at this point, that's a huge hope to get back to the status quo ante. It's, you know, where you know, he's got Crimea and less than half of Luhansk, or the combined territory of Luhansk and Donetsk. If you do try to push it back, in the event that you were lucky enough to have the option of pushing him back further than that, which I frankly doubt will happen, then at that point it does to him seem, I think, like an existential threat, not to Russia but to his regime, because the politics of that would be so grim, because that's an out and out loss. In fact, I think it's a loss for him domestically if he's pushed back the status quo ante. But in any event, the grief Kissinger took for saying just something that's kind of obviously true. I mean, if you think you can get Russia out of Crimea, where, by the way, most people apparently want Russia to stay, most Crimeans, I'm not saying that justifies what Russia did, but it's now the fact. If you think you can get Russia out of Crimea without seriously courting something like the apocalypse, I mean, at a minimum, a much scarier regional war, possibly nuclear, I just think you're nuts. And, but God, Kissinger, people, including Zelensky, acted as if, you know, he's some kind of war criminal.
Well, I think the more they get Zelensky to say, we will never give up Crimea, we will never give up Crimea, the better, because then in the end, he can give up Crimea. It seems like a big sacrifice.
But it becomes harder for him to do that in terms of his own domestic politics, as he says that more and more.
Well, that's actually, but that's an argument that the Applebaums and the others make, is that, well, you can't expect Zelensky to offer him an off-ramp because he could, Ukrainian politics would never tolerate that.
Well, first of all, I mean, that's a whole interesting thing that if I don't discuss here, I'll discuss in the Parrot Room. But, you know, I don't think we have a super clear idea of what exactly the Ukrainian people want. And there's not a lot of vigorous debate on this subject, as I understand it. One thing I learned a couple of weeks ago from a podcast, and this was very much a pro-Ukraine podcast, the interlocutor, the guest, everything. But the guest had been to Ukraine, knows Ukraine very well. And, you know, there used to be six TV stations in Ukraine, apparently, each owned by a different oligarch. Since the war started, there is one TV channel. It's not technically run by the government. It's technically a collaboration of like the six oligarchs or something. But there are rules. And one rule is you cannot criticize Zelensky on TV. Okay, so we are not seeing, and look, I'm not saying America would be any more permissive if it had the kind of war where its actual territory is being intruded on, right, which we've never had, basically. But it is not, there is not free-flowing debate in either Ukraine or Russia right now. There's less of it in Russia, I'm sure, but there's not probably a ton in Ukraine. So I don't know how we know how an actual debate in Ukraine would work out on this subject, but I will say, you know, it's easy for all of us to sit back, and even in a certain sense for Zelensky to sit back, because he's not on the front lines, and say, well, you know, however long it takes, you know, however many dead Ukrainians and maimed Ukrainians it takes, however many refugees, however many dead Russians, it's easy for us to say that, but we're talking a lot of carnage, and increasingly just the complete and utter destruction of Ukraine physically.
What one thing I didn't understand about what Kissinger said is he said Russia is an important balance in Europe. What does he mean by that?
I didn't read all the remarks.
Policy concepts like balance. What is Russia balancing? Us? I think they're balancing us.
Don't know exactly what he means by that. No, I mean, he is an old-fashioned balance of power.
Right, but usually, I mean, I once had to proofread a Henry Kissinger article in Newsweek, which was completely incomprehensible. And somebody explained to me, when Kissinger wants to be clear, he's perfectly capable of being clear. He's unclear in this article because he wants to be unclear. In this case, he wanted to be clear. I mean, I think he was speaking via Skype to the Davos convention.
I mean, all he seems to me, all Russia seems to me to be balancing is NATO. I don't know. I mean, now he could mean potentially China, but for the near future, partly as a result of this war, Russia's going to be virtually a client state of China's.
So I wanted to read the last paragraph of Anne Applebaum's piece because it seems completely utopian and idealistic in a way that I haven't heard since the 1960s when, you know, people were talking about the ecstatic mode of being that was going to follow the revolution. Military loss could create a real opening for national self-examination or for a major change, he's talking about in Russia, as it so often does in Russia's past. Only failure can persuade the Russians themselves to question the sense and purpose of a colonial ideology that has repeatedly impoverished and ruined their own economy and society as well as those of their neighbors for decades. Yet another frozen conflict, yet another temporary holding pattern, yet another face-saving compromise will not end the pattern of Russian aggression or bring permanent peace.
Well, I would say if setbacks for foreign adventurism have that kind of feedback effect, why is Anne Applebaum, even after the Iraq War, still have this huge platform at the Atlantic? If self-examination actually worked within countries, you know, she would not be a prominent voice. She and her whole, you know, crew of fellow hawks, neocons, and so on. That's perhaps an unfairly personal reply I'm giving you, but the true answer is it's like, yeah, it could happen. But, you know, I think history shows that all kinds of shit can happen. He can be deposed in a palace coup and it can be worse.
A true defeat could force the reckoning that should have happened in the 1990s. She wants a reckoning. Everybody wants a reckoning. The I'm sure Putin will be eager to take his eager to stop the war if he knows that the results will be a reckoning in which he, you know, he'll be reckoned out of power. Anyway,
yeah, it's just a triple bank shot.
There's this, but there's this ecstatic, you know, we want this reckoning in which the revolutionary forces will win and everybody will see the light. There's this similarity between Applebaum and the left and the new neocons of the left, and there, it's pie in the sky in both.
Which part of the left on what issue?
Reckoning. You haven't heard about the racial reckoning that's happening after Black Lives Matter. It's all about everything in the press is now a reckoning. Reckoning of privilege, reckoning of this, reckoning of that.
And they...
remaking the flaws of society with a reckoning.
I don't know. I mean, the number of people who just say flat out crazy shit and are treated as major intellectuals is just scary. She said crazier stuff than this. We talked about it.
Okay. If that's true, I love it.
If what you say is if what true, you I say love is. It. Let's see what else. Now, just quickly, Biden said that we will intervene militarily if China attacks Taiwan. And then the White House said, well, not quite so much.
And why isn't he just reestablishing strategic ambiguity? In other words, now the ambiguity is, who are the Chinese going to believe, Biden or his aides? In a way that sort of slightly toughens our stance against them, which is probably appropriate. So in the end, the outcome isn't such a disaster.
Well, I mean, people have said that almost in a joking way, like, yeah, new level of strategic ambiguity. It seems to me, if you want to preserve strategic, I would say the problem is he just comes off as incompetent. And now maybe it's like, you know, madman theory, like, well, then they think, you know, America's run by crazy people. Who knows? Don't invade. They could do anything. That's, I suppose, it's possible.
In this case, it could be enhanced by fears of senility.
Yeah.
In other words, the
well, really
senile
good.
Old man will order a war, you know,
really could.
In his allocated state.
If they really think he means it, of course, it provides this kind of perverse incentive to invade now, while America is, you know, has less of a presence there than it will have, and Taiwan has less American arms than they'll have, you know.
That's a good point.
In a few years, it's the same. We've talked about this a little bit. It's just like in Ukraine, where we're like, let's flood them with weapons. It'll be a deterrent. And Putin is like, I think I better go now. You know, there's only going to be more NATO advisors and weapons as the years roll.
Bizarrely, Fiona Hill said one of the reasons she validated the madman theory recently by telling some talk show host or interviewer that she thinks Putin didn't invade under Trump precisely because he didn't know how Trump would react. Trump is a madman. He's not rational. And he figured Biden was rational, therefore he could deal with him if he invaded. It's just a weird, unlikely source for the madman theory.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think in retrospect, it might have been good for, you know, Biden said, we will not intervene militarily. It was virtually an assurance for Putin, or he could have taken it that way. I personally thought if there was, you know, one reason that I would be tempted to say that loud if I were president is because given the American domestic forces in favor of intervention, you almost have to like state your position publicly to make it irrevocable, you know, to make it credible. Otherwise, I'm not sure what the logic of saying that out loud is. The thing he might have said out loud in retrospect is, but we will arm them to the hilt if there's an invasion. That probably wouldn't have worked if Putin was indeed under the impression that the whole thing was going to be over in a week. I don't know if he was, but I don't know.
The anyway.
We're getting into pretty advanced and arcane game theory, or pretty speculative game theory.
The other thing that's happened, this is what I was going to say. The other thing that's happened is American public opinion is turning against the hard pro let's back Ukraine to the hilt position.
Is that right?
Yes. There's it used to be 51-44 in favor of Ukraine. Now it's 51-44 against Ukraine, just in terms of what is your priority, helping Ukraine or helping, America not have any consequences from the Soviets. And it's flipped. And I think people like Hawley, crazy as they are getting some traction with why are we spending $40 billion on Ukraine? Think of what that could buy in the U.S.
Yeah, he wrote a piece in, what is it, Compact Magazine, the new quasi-Trumpist, kind of conservative nationalist, the one put out by that guy who used to be editorial page opinion editor at the New York Post.
Okay.
You know the guy.
That guy.
That guy. We both agree that there's a guy whose name. Why can't everyone have names like Bob and Mickey? Remember when America was like that, Mickey, and nobody had these foreign names? And we could remember them all because all of them were either Bob or Mickey.
No. Anyway, so that's happening.
Hawley,
so
that's militating in
favor of Biden giving as many arms as possible now, because the public support for it is not going to be there in the future.
Well, Zelensky is now he is starting to concede that things are going badly in the Donbass. And saying, so we need all these weapons more than ever. Hurry up. We need more long-range weapons. I guess they do, but geez. I mean, my understanding is they're having trouble as far as what we have given them so far. It'll be weeks before they even assimilate that and know how to use it. It's like, I guess there's a specific multiple, rocket launcher thing they need. I don't know. But
which we've now agreed to give them.
I guess. Have we already?
Happened today.
Wouldn't shock me. But, there's of course the economic downside of all the sanctions and not to mention just the sheer deficit spending of giving them $40 billion. And, all that is inflationary. All of that is inflationary and inflation's a problem. And that may be pointed out in the run-up to the elections.
And I guess we should also mention that Russia's secret weapon is turning out to be this blockade that is stopping food going to a whole bunch of countries in Africa, and including Egypt. And that they said, "Oh well, we'll let the food through if you relax the sanctions." So there's that's in play too.
And just quickly related to that, one last kind of tactical or strategic thing. I don't think we just should assume that Russia has given up on taking Odessa, in which case they would turn Ukraine into a landlocked country. And that's one reason that, Ukraine faces some tough choices now, like with Severodonetsk on the verge of being surrounded. It's like, do you withdraw troops to fight another day and make it less likely that they can take Odessa, or do you do another Mariupol, and lose thousands of troops? Presumably there's that many there to either, death, being wounded or being imprisoned.
I assume the Ukraine strategy is that the Russians are advancing now, but they're going to get exhausted and their supply lines are going to run short and they're going to be much weaker in 2 months from now.
That is a commonly said thing, and it could well be true. They may not manage to take all of Donetsk. They may not even take this final city in Luhansk. Who knows? But I've heard there's this pretty smart former military officer named, is it Daniel Davis or something? He's one of these kind of conservative restrainers, I think. And he said, look, if you're gonna, if you want to even have a hope of ever pushing them out of, the Donbass, you really should avoid getting many troops trapped now. You should do tactical retreats and create a new line, a new perimeter of defense where there isn't one, Because remember, I mean, the Russians are moving so slowly because the Ukrainians are so dug in along certain lines. But once the Russians are past that, unless they are completely exhausted, they may be able to move pretty fast.
Right. So there were also elections this past week.
I forgot to comment on them. Quickly.
The most important election, recent election, was the Cuellar Cisneros House race. Cuellar is a Democrat who has turned conservative on, among other issues, abortion, and he's the last anti-abortion Democrat who voted against the big bill they had to allegedly codify Roe v. Wade. It actually went much further. But anyway, this is his second race against a former aide who is progressive, has turned on him, is backed by Bernie Sanders. He was backed by the entire Democratic House establishment, although with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Clyburn did go down and campaign for him. And the other thing is that the FBI just happened to search his house in the run-up to the election. And everybody says, well, this is a bit of bad luck on his part. And I don't have enough faith in the FBI to think it was bad luck anymore. It had to do with Azerbaijan, by the way. They just say they raided his house. They don't say what it was about. It was about an investigation of some shenanigans involving Azerbaijan. Hmm. Anyway, Cuellar seems to have won by like 5 votes, but it's actually like 170 or something, but there's going to be a recount. It's unlikely that the recount will overturn the result, but it's possible. But it looks like that the future of the Democratic Party is still, they always say the future is up for grabs. And then if the progressive doesn't win, they say, well, the next time the future will be up for grabs. I mean, the press really wants the progressive to win. I really want the progressive to lose. And it looks like she's going to again this time.
And as for Republicans, the weekly ritual of using primary results to gauge the degree of Trump's strength within the Republican Party, I didn't keep up with it, but I got to say I was pretty gratified by the results in Georgia. I mean, Trump people got blown away. And these are the iconic people for his attempt to overthrow the election, especially Raffensperger, the Secretary of State. People didn't think he could win without a runoff. He won without a runoff, right? And then Kemp, the governor. These are the people Trump tried to, intimidate.
I know people who thought, Kemp should clearly win, but they thought Raffensperger should lose just because he resisted Trump at the end, which obviously he was right to do, but he gave away way too much to Stacey Abrams in the negotiations before the election. Mm. On the other hand, they cracked down and they still had record turnout, so. Maybe all these negotiations with Stacey Abrams don't really have that much effect. Anyway, I agree, but I think voters separate the indulging Trump's petty retribution fantasies with supporting him if he runs for president again. And so he wins, 40% to 30% to 20% instead of 60% to 40%. He's still the likeliest nominee if he runs again. Unfortunately, I wish that wasn't true.
Because you think he'll lose unless he's running against Joe Biden.
No, I think he'll win the nomination.
Right, but
I haven't gotten to the general yet. I think he beats Joe Biden, and the Democratic field, the replacements for Joe Biden are not very encouraging. There was a mediocre article in New York Magazine that didn't even run through enough of them, but they're all people who Trump could beat. It's not like Kamala Harris isn't beatable by Trump. Okay.
Run through them in the Parrot Room. We're at an hour.
The other point that I think is the other headline point, I'll make it quickly, is this guy Fetterman, who we've been tracking.
Paul Bunyan.
It turns out he had a heart condition and he had a stroke, and he claims that it was AFib. It was only AFib, and they putting on a pacemaker, and he's going to be back on the trail.
And the question is this AFib? Get it? What he's saying?
Very witty, Bob.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, because the treatment he got, as the New York Times pointed out, is something you normally get for somebody who has an actual weakness in the heart muscle, not just a rhythmic problem. And so he might have a much deeper heart problem than he's letting on, which is an impression that's reinforced as he takes his sweet time to get back on the campaign trail. It's possible that his wife is so popular that his wife will take the mantle of his nomination and do a perfectly good job. But it's troubling for the Democrats. That this happened to him.
Let's talk more election in the parrot room at patreon.com/parrot room. I do want you to run through the possible Trump opponents. Other things, you have other things you're going to be talking about?
I think there's the Sussman trial, which is going to go to the jury very soon. The question is, Hillary sent this story to the press. How guilty was Frank for in publishing it?
And he wrote the piece in Slate.
Claiming that there was a secret connection. I'm not so sure that we can rule out that there was a secret connection, but, it'd be interesting to see if he puts up a good defense.
Okay, we can talk about that.
We could talk about severance again. I have a couple things to say.
That's the TV show.
We talk about Kellyanne Conway's book that came out and Trump attacked her, even though she didn't attack him.
Okay.
But she did attack Jared. I haven't read Elon Musk's tweets, but I will read them by the time of the parrot room.
There's Twitter.
Tony Blinken's big speech, which I'm sure you have an opinion on.
I didn't like read the whole thing. I certainly have opinions on Tony Blinken.
You read more of it than I did. There's Peter Thiel is now possibly being the biggest kingmaker of the election cycle.
Money can do that for a man.
He also has good candidate choice. There's the difference between the Bush dynasty and the Clinton dynasty, both of which have collapsed. Tim Russert's son, Luke, has opened up the national service debate again. I don't know if you want to get into that. We got all these wastrel men.
Okay, I'll just say yes, if that'll keep you from elaborating now. Yes, by all means, let's talk about that in the parrot room.
Do you want to talk about monkeypox instead, Bob?
Can't get enough of it. Monkeypox. I'm writing it down. That's about nine things.
Okay. Well, I have nine, Bob. How many do you have?
You don't have to sound competitive about it, Mickey. This is a collaborative endeavor.
I'm just saying who's pulling the weight in terms of generating gratuitous topics to talk about.
Let me see. Well, first of all, I want to, if there's anybody out there who isn't sick of my rants indicting the mainstream media's coverage of the Ukraine war, and in particular, the reliance of outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post on the Institute for the Study of War, funded by the arms industry, run by neocons, you're in luck because there's going to be more. I actually figured out what it is about the way the Institute for the Study of War covers Ukraine that does create this like several day lag in any bad news for Ukraine actually reaching the brains of Americans.
Some bad news recently.
I know. They finally got around to sharing it with us, but I really understand something more clearly. And I do want to, I have specific trashing of the Times and the Post I want to do. Relatively speaking, I think the Wall Street Journal comes out looking good, by the way. So aside from that.
Do you have opinions on John Kerry and other Democratic officials undermining Trump's attempts to nix the Iran deal? Like basically encouraging Iran to hang tough, I assume.
I'm not sure what you're talking about, but I'm happy to talk about recent developments in the Iran deal and Biden being, a total coward there. So I'm writing that down. I just got a tiny bit of an update about the podcast Dead End about murder and corruption in New Jersey in areas shockingly close to where I live. We could talk about the Princeton professor who was fired. Do you have any, that's in your neck of the woods, right? I didn't know that much about it. He allegedly is a victim of a martyr for free speech.
It's one of those things where, you know, they have some argument against him, but it's a pretext for punishing him for his speech.
Well,
which
if
I believe,
that's your view, then you have a view.
But that's an inherently duller, that's a duller debate than he was innocent.
Okay, we'll see if we may debate that. Station 11, I finally finished this, you know, epic TV series. I'll have things to say.
I hope it wasn't about the redemptive power of art.
It's about, I would say, the redemptive power of art. but that's not all you can say about it.
It's enough for me.
Yeah, well, we've said that. I just want to report back, since we've been talking about it for weeks in the Parrot Room, and say that I finally made it, and I think I deserve a medal. No, it's interesting. So that's a lot of stuff. We'll try to talk about almost all of it in the Parrot Room. Patreon.com/Parrot Room. Oh, yeah, click the like button on YouTube. Do us a favor. Rate and review.
Where you can experience the redemptive power of art.
The redemptive power of art.
All right. We'll see you there.
Of our art.